Welcome, welcome, and thank you for joining us wherever you're listening. This podcast is sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water. It's amazing. Thank you, Cooker, for supporting the podcast. And it's great. We're sponsored by a product that I truly love. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's podcast is another celebrity special, 19 questions to Jason Fox. Well, actually, it's 15 questions to Jason Fox. I've tried my hardest to do 19, and sadly, it just doesn't fit as I talk far too much. So 15 questions to Jason Fox, and obviously a bonus question if I like his answers. I've had Jason on the podcast before when he had his first book out, which was called Battle Scars. Excellent book, excellent read. We talked all about his weaknesses as well as his strengths. That's what the book was about. It wasn't sort of one of these books where Special Forces takes on a hundred of the enemy and beats them single-handedly. It was about the emotions which you go through when you go into war and when you join Special Forces. He even talked once about, thinking, I want my mum. It's an amazing book to read. And he had to overcome PTSD too. And actually, that's why he left the forces in the end. His latest book is a self-help book. It's called Life Under Fire, and it's all about those experiences Life Under Fire, how to build inner strength and thrive under pressure. Well, these guys who are in the Special Forces, they know all about that, don't they? Let's meet him. Here he is. Here's Jason Fox. Hello, Jason. How are you?
How's it going, mate? Good, thanks. Yeah.
I have to say, the last time I interviewed you on this podcast, we were filming them back then, and we put yours up on YouTube. It did fantastic business. But under the comments section, it did make me laugh, because most of the comments are the fact that I called you SAS at one stage rather than SBS. And the people that, people who are into the Special Forces, it's hardcore, isn't it? I mean, I was not forgiven for that at all.
Well, to be honest, mate, they are one and the same thing. You see, you can be excused, I suppose, but it's when we'd filmed the first season and then we went away and they decided on a name. Apparently we were told it was going to be called The Selection or something generic. And I remember I was driving up the M40 actually, and I got a phone call. I answered it and they were like, right, yeah, we've had a week's long sort of like debate about what we're going to call it. We're going to call it SAS Who Dares Wins. And I was like, what? I was like, three of us were in the SBS. It's like, what's going on? But fast forward to now, people will like say, like stop me and be like, oh, you're that lad that was in the SAS. And I'm like, yeah, that's right, yeah. So it's like I've gone past the point of like correcting, because it doesn't really matter.
Oh, because you all work together in the end, don't you?
Yeah, you do, yeah. You do the same course and then you're all sort of, you're like the squadron I was in was sistered up with a squadron from the SAS anyway, so you all work, you sort of like cross-pollinate and it creates good atmosphere and it gets rid of all that old school animosity, hopefully.
What is the difference then traditionally between, obviously I know one's water-based, but what is the difference in the training and everything? Was there ever a difference?
I think there was for a period of time, like when both sort of groups were first born in the Second World War, there wasn't really a defining thing between them, because different people jumped across to each one and everyone was rogue back in the day during the Second World War, and they just did their own things. And I suppose if someone was operating out of Turkey or Greece, they were probably part of the SBS, but if they're in North Africa, then it was the SAS. That's as far as, I'm not a mega history buff on it, but that's what it was. And then after the Second World War, they did go their own separate ways for a little bit. They got disbanded. They got, reintroduced to the army or the Marines, and they sort of did their own thing. And then sort of at the beginning, I suppose midway through the 90s, common sense would dictate that they needed to come together and like be under one umbrella, which is what they are now.
You're fascinated by the fact that people are, I'm going to use the word again, are so fascinated by the SAS and SBS. Their app, people love it, don't they? They love reading the stories. Yeah. They love hearing about you guys. It's quite a fan club you've got.
It is. It's fascinating, but I suppose it. I could turn around and say, "Oh, I just don't know what the appeal is." And then when I look back to when I was a kid before I joined the military, I had the same fascination. Yet there was just less in the public domain. And obviously, over time, that's changed. But yeah, I can see what the fascination is because, you know, even though we're on TV, you know, gobbing off about X, Y, and Z, which we're not really gobbing off about, we're just sort of like delivering some, you know, words of wisdom, hopefully. But ultimately, it is still shrouded in mystery. Like all the stuff, all the nitty gritty stuff that I got up to and other people got up to, you still can't really talk about it because there's still people out there doing it. And that's why the mystique still exists and people still want to sort of know what's going on.
We had a guy come on Sunday brunch once talking about the history of it. And to begin with, they were basically psychopaths. They got involved in it, absolute lunatics who just wanted more fun in the war, you know? And then now it's become obviously very pro, professional and everyone knows what they're doing. But I mean, it started off as quite something else, wasn't it? It was just like, let's get guys and throw them behind enemy lines.
Yeah. I think they were obviously like rogue and, thank God for the war. Otherwise it'd probably ended up in prison, but anyway,
very, very true. And their life expectancy was pretty low back then. Let's talk about your book, Life Under Fire, How to Build Inner Strength and Thrive Under Pressure. It's I love reading it, actually. It's really good. For anyone who doesn't know what it's about, can you give us the basic concept of it?
Basic concept is I wrote a book called Battle Scars, which was more an autobiography of my journey with mental health more than anything. I think people thought it was going to be a bit of a war-y book, but I don't think it is. And because of that, it made me reflect and I realized that there was lessons that I'd learned or been taught along the way that helped me get through what I'd gone through in that book. And I figured that Life Under Fire is like those lessons. It's like meat on the bones of that first book, I suppose. It's probably a bit more, you could treat it as a reference book as well, maybe, I hope.
Do you enjoy writing these books?
Yeah, I do. I do it obviously with a bloke that knows what he's doing, called Matt Allen, and we've become good friends. So I do enjoy it. Yeah, we have a good crack doing it. I mean, the first one was quite hard, if I'm honest. It was, you know, I was having to expose a bit. This one was a lot more fun because it was actually exploring different reasons of why and how I got to where I am now. But also it touches on other things that I've noticed in other people or stuff that we've researched along the way.
Yeah, I love the first one, as you know. I like this one as well, but the first one was really good because I'm so used to reading SAS books where everyone's a hero and there's, you know, there's nothing, there's no sort of emotions really involved. And then when your book came along, it was very different, really different. Interesting, fascinating read. I recommend anyone read that one if they want to know what it's really like to be in the special forces and also have your life threatened by people. It's kind of a weird thing to put yourself through. Right, let's do these questions with you, Jason. What one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life? I've done this before with you, but it's probably changed after you've written Life Under Fire.
I don't know whether it has. It's funny, the way I think about it has changed. So the one piece of advice that has been invaluable throughout my life But before my sort of like mental breakdown, it was a subconscious way of thinking about things. And then I forgot about it. And then afterwards it was conscious, so I can now talk about it because I understand what it is. And it's like, it is to lead a life slightly more akin to an 18-month-old toddler, as in like living more in the now. As adults, we spend too much time dwelling on the past and worrying about the future. And the now is something that we don't concentrate on. And it's actually not, whether it's a good or bad time for anyone, you should still be more present because you probably work out if times are bad, why they're bad. And if they're good, you're going to enjoy it more. So it's a bit more about being a toddler because they do live in the now. They don't generally forget. They forget about tripping over 2 seconds ago and hurting themselves and crying. And then they don't worry about doing it again. They just they're inquisitive and they soak up so much information that's coming at them, and they have a good time doing it, they fall over again, but they pick themselves up. So we want to be a bit more like that.
And I suppose when you're on a mission, that is what you've got to do. You've got to live in the now. You can't be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it was something that was taught to me, but it was in my subconscious. So when I was in the military, I was doing it anyway. And I never really, and again, it goes back to Life Under Fire. Cause I was like, how the hell did we do all that? And it was about looking back and then actually being a bit conscious about the fact that actually, all because of our training, everything became second nature, but we were just living in the now. You know, we didn't worry about someone being shot that had just happened, or, you know, people getting badly injured. We had to concentrate, and we weren't worried about that happening again. We just had to concentrate on the, you know, that moment you're in to try and succeed.
Hmm. Next question. What does success mean to you?
Ooh, this is quite difficult. I'd say success is, I measure success in the ability to pick yourself back up after failure. If you can bounce back quickly from failure, I'd say that's a success, because you're on the road to learning more about yourself. So it's not about, oh, I've got to the end of my life, I've got billions of pounds in the bank and I'm sort of miserable as sin. Success is about having had a good time, but leading life, you know, falling over and picking yourself back up. I think success is all about, you know, picking yourself back up after those trips.
David Goggins changed my life a bit. I love reading about David Goggins. Yeah, you're aware of you are, aren't you? I've spoken.
Yeah.
Absolute psycho, but I love him. He's absolutely nuts. But the one thing he says that I love is he says there is no finishing line. You've got to keep going. And I think that's great, because what you just said there is like, you get to the end of your life and you think, I want to be sitting on a beach, or, you know, with a cocktail. Bullshit, keep going. You know, there is none of that. But
that's the whole point with that success thing. It's like, but what is success? Because you never, you know, you shouldn't want to be somewhere. You should just want to keep tripping yourself up to pick yourself back up again, I reckon.
Yeah. For anyone who doesn't know, by the way, David Goggins is in the Special Forces in the USA, or was. And he is just completely insane guy. He was huge overweight, got himself through he's been through all the training. He's been in the Rangers, the Navy SEALs, he's been in everything. And he's also done ultra marathons. He's got the chin up champion, you know, record, Guinness record. He just obsessively runs like 20 miles a day, every day. It's insane. But the one thing he did say was he used to train before training when he was in the army. And I was like, I talked to you about this, didn't I, when you were last in Sunday Brunch? Like, this is absolutely insane. What sort of person does that sort of stuff? Did you have people like that around you?
Yeah, there are. I think they come in different shapes and sizes, and they do, like, I was with a group of people that were probably guilty of doing a bit extra training, but not like, I mean, he is like an immense ball of energy, like on another scale. But there are people that I've served with and spent a lot of time with who are obsessive about things like that, and that when they will go out and keep doing, you know, will come back from doing a training session and they've disappeared again. They're doing another one. You're like, that. Where's he gone? Is he all right? Do we need to check him out?
I think Goggins eventually became the trainer for his regiment, and they hated him for it because he pushed them so much. If you ever read Jerry Itzler's book about he got Goggins to live with him for a month, and what was interesting is that every time Goggins walks into a restaurant, he checks out who the potential enemy can be, where the emergency exits are, and he's obsessive about that. Have you managed to switch off, or are you still in that mode like he is?
I'm sort of, I think I and everyone I know, friends that are still either, well, let's concentrate on the people that have left, are still like that to a certain degree. It does people, yeah it does my missus's head in sometimes. But I like to, I'm like that. Well, we live in London. We should remain alert. You know, times are difficult. But yeah, I do sort of like, I wouldn't have said it's hypervigilant now, but I'm aware, situationally aware. Like, I think that's a healthier way of putting it.
Okay, all right. Next question. What's the best moment of your career?
Ooh. As in, when we say career, what are we on about?
Well, I don't know, because you've had two careers, haven't you? You've had one in the SBS, and then you've got your TV career. You choose. What's the best moment?
I think... It was passed in selection, after being in the Marines and sort of, I loved being a soldier, but I didn't enjoy the pomp and ceremony that goes with, being in certain units. And there is an element of that, even though the Marines are an extremely elite bunch of people, there still was that element of pomp, and I can't stand it. I hate the bullshit that goes with that. And that's not to say it's not necessary. It's just I don't enjoy it. And so to remain being a soldier, which I loved, I needed to go and take a different route. And it was a difficult one. And eventually getting to the end of it, that was a pretty proud moment for me career-wise.
Did you ever think you'd make it through? Was there ever any doubts that you would make it through the training?
I never thought there was any doubt in my head, but I did sit there thinking, is this ever going to fucking end? there were times when I was like, is this actually possible? I'm like, because I mean, I look back on it. I sit down with friends and we look back on it, and sometimes we're like, how the hell did we do some of that stuff? Like, honestly, it boils down to sheer stubbornness sometimes, but yeah. There were moments.
Do you talk about that in your book? Is it a way of overcoming it and just thinking about the end goal? And as you say, just like a toddler, take every day at a time.
Yeah, it is 100%. Like at the beginning, probably just before I started, I actually did, and I'm not a lunatic or anything, but I do believe in visualizing things. Work is a great motivator, and I had pictured myself before I'd even started at the end. You know, as a person that was in a special forces squadron, I didn't know what that actually looked like, but I just had an idea of it in my head. And then after that, I just sort of, I dealt with that 1 meter square. I dealt with whatever threw itself at me after that.
The podcast I did a couple of podcasts ago was with a brain surgeon called James Doty. He wrote a book called Into the Magic Shop. And there's actual scientific evidence basically now that your brain, if you start visualizing and opening it up, things will happen. And the easiest way to explain that is if you don't ever imagine it, it won't happen. That's the
exactly
explaining it. And so you open it up, and we were discussing how I sort of he visualized being a doctor and he had no right to be, and he ended up a brain surgeon. I end up being a TV presenter and I had no right to be. So it's like visualizing the end of the training might be the way to do it. Right. What's the worst moment of your career?
It has to be the obvious one, really. And that was when I first got medically discharged, because it was not that it was a bad thing looking back on it. There's, I don't see anything as bad. I see it as just a building block to the new you. But at the time, it was a very low point, was being medically discharged for PTSD, because I was confused about it, really. So it's an obvious answer to your question, but it is what it is.
It's good. And how long did it take you to come to terms with it?
So 5th of April 2012, I left. And I went, like, there was a massively, probably an 18-month dark period, which always seems grey and fuzzy. And then after that, it started to get better, but I don't think I don't think I was completely over it until, so I'd done the first series of SAS, then I did the Atlantic. After the Atlantic row, that's when everything was back in place, and I realized what it was I needed to do properly. The journey to the light had started long before that, but sort of mid 2016, four years, definitely it took.
Was there ever a time you thought you were never going to get to the light at the end of the tunnel?
Probably that moment stood on top of the cliff. But I think that was, when was that? That was sort of end of 2013, that sort of period. And that was when I was like, right, hang on a minute. I've got, it's that dark here. I either stay here or I do something about it, stay there being, launch myself off a cliff, or do something about it, walk away and change things and change your mindset.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things to do in life, is when you hit that brick wall, to go, right, I need to do something about this now, get up, what's the next step, and I think that's important. What's the right? The next question is, what's the key to a good? What's the key to good relationship? I think I'm gonna steer you a bit into the direction of your fellow special forces guys, because I think that's a really interesting relationship that we would never have to encounter.
The key to a good relationship, regardless of what that looks like, I think there's a few different things that come into play here. There's obviously the trust and loyalty. That's what you do have within that organization. You know, there is an immense amount of trust and loyalty, regardless of whether you like someone or not. You know what your common goal is. You're there for each other to achieve a mission. There has to be an element of empathy as well. You've got to try, even if you don't understand someone, you've got to slow down and try to, you know, try and see things from their point of view, whatever that may be. But then the one thing that works in, like, especially that organization is, and what I think is key to anything, you know, whatever that relationship work otherwise, is communication. And that can look like all sorts of things. But if you don't talk and communicate, then the misunderstanding becomes so big that you're it's almost like you're alien to one another, and you don't understand, you've got no idea what's going on that side of the room or the building or whatever, because you just don't communicate. There's no two-way communication.
Are you good friends with people you served with?
Yeah, really good.
Does that just bond you forever?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, for instance, I've worked with like a lot of people, but like the good friend, you know, I could bump into them and we'll have any one of them and have a bit of a laugh and a crack, and we'd reminisce about certain things. But there are only a handful of people that I remain in contact with. Some still serving, and some have either just left or left about the same time as me.
When you do your program, SES Who Dares Wins, how many of the people, contestants you get on, do you think could actually be, could have served with you? Like a percentage, what would it be? 1%? None?
Definitely not none, surprisingly, because there's been some shockers, if I'm honest. But there's definitely like, there's three that stand out in my mind out of a God knows how many. So what's that? Let's say 1%, 1 or 2%.
Yeah, I suppose you have to not have attitude if you want to do it, because you've
actually, yeah, there's four actually, and one of them's a celeb.
Oh, so, can you tell us which one?
Yeah, of course. It's my opinion, but I've got like a lot of time for Bridgie.
Wayne Bridge.
Yeah. He really did impress me. He was a wild card coming in as well. He wasn't, as far as I'm aware, he wasn't even going to be on it. And then something happened to one of the others, and he got brought in as that sort of wild card, and he came in and smashed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
He's got an engine on him, and he's got so much determination. His lack of confidence could have nearly tripped him up, but he managed to keep that at bay.
Interesting. Good stuff. Mm-hmm. All right. What group are you, or were you part of? And obviously we can't have your job. Is there anything you ever joined, or were you part of a group of any description?
As a kid, I think I dabbled in the Scouts, but I was pretty rubbish at that.
How can you be rubbish at the Scouts?
I sort of liked doing the stuff, but it didn't really, I don't know. I felt a bit odd doing it, you know, with all the sort of, I don't remember sticking with it for too long for some reason.
I joined the Cubs for football, and then we went into the Scouts, and then I kind of enjoyed the camping and stuff. It was all right, but it was just the uniform just used to get on my nerves.
It's exactly what I'm on about. Like, you know, the thing that you still have to wear around your neck. It seems stupid. I don't mean to take anything away from, it's a great movement and organisation, and you should stick with it if you're a kid listening in. But yeah, I didn't agree with that toggle thing and whatnot.
But I suppose it's discipline, which is what we all need. And so I suppose it's a good education. It's good. So
it's true. Yeah.
All right. Next question. What other jobs did you do? Did you do any before you went in?
Not really. I've worked on a farm doing bits and pieces just before I joined up, just to get some, just get a bit of pocket money, really. So I got I think it was my aunt got me a job on a farm, mucking stuff out and whatnot.
But when you came out, you did sort of proper jobs, normal jobs, shall we say? Because you wrote about it in your last book, how you found it very frustrating because people were lying.
Yeah, it was a bit. I worked for not that anyone, they weren't lying. It was just, well, yeah, they were. They were just avoiding the truth and taking responsibility. But I worked for a facilities management company, which was, it was. Do you know what? I'm glad I did it, but it was, and if anything, I wasn't very good at it because all I wanted to do was skive off and go to the gym and train. So like, whenever anyone tried to find me, I wasn't behind my desk. I'd sort of like managed to scamper away and hide. But I think that was just because it was a frustrating time of my life.
Do you think, right, when you're writing Life Under Fire, this book, it's like, it's quite a good thing you did that experience of that job, because most of us, we don't have we wouldn't have experienced what you've experienced, where everyone has to come together because you could end up dying. You know, we're work for majority of us is a game, you know, in the entertainment industry. I don't know what you feel about it, but it's a huge game in the entertainment industry. Most of us, it's not real life, you know, and it's a strange game we're all playing out. And as you say, there are people who will maybe lie, and there's deceitful people, and there's people who are being cruel to each other. So when you're writing this book, was it good that you actually saw how the rest of us have lived our lives?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was that was part of my lesson, really, was to look at how I should be moving forward, and like some home truths about myself. You know, I've been in situations where I've not conducted myself in a good way. But I think going back to like what you say about the TV sort of world being a game, yeah, I suppose I see where you're coming from. But then people within it also, they need to be a bit careful, because a lot of people listen to those people in that game. And so a lot of people out there have got a lot of influence over how people see, how people feel and conduct themselves. And they should sometimes take it a little bit seriously, you know, with regard to what they're trying to, whether it's talk about or you know, what they're trying to spin. I don't know.
You mean social media and things, celebrities, that sort of stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I think so.
It's interesting you talk about conducting yourself well. When I entered the industry 25 years ago or whatever, everyone always said, Tim, you've got to be so careful. Everyone's going to stab you in the back. Everyone's horrible. This is a cutthroat industry. And it possibly was. But I never really fitted into that mold. But I tried my hardest to be cutthroat and stab people in the back. But it just, you know, it was just what the print industry and the TV industry and all the entertainment industry, they were horrible. They were like, you got threatened to be sacked every 2 seconds. Things have really changed now.
Yeah.
I always think what you say about conducting yourself, I think that's really important. There's been a few times I've gone home at night and thought, I didn't conduct myself very well today. I'm not proud of that. And that's not good. And, you know, and I think that's one of the important things in life, is to go home every night and go, I conducted myself okay today. That's cool.
Yeah, but that's a good thing though, isn't it? To be that aware, at least you're acknowledging when, I mean, I still do it. I'll have done something and I'm like, you know, X amount of time after the event or whatever it is that I've done, I'll be like, no, that's not good. You need to either, you know, write that or don't do it again.
Like, talking about cutthroat, aren't all the guys who are leaving the forces who are in the special forces, aren't they all looking at your jobs, you and Ant and everyone? They're going, we want their job. It's a pretty good job.
I don't know, maybe. Some are, some aren't. I don't know. There's a lot of people. I've got mates out there that are, mates, it's awesome, well done. It's funny. They laugh at me. They take the, you know, it's just the banter's still there.
Right, okay. What is your outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad.
Well, the thing is, look at me, I'm wearing black again. That's all. I open my wardrobe and I'm like, maybe I should be a bit more adventurous. I'll tell you what, actually, there is something funny. A few months ago, I managed to get my agent phones me and says, oh, we've got you, you've got a front cover piece on the Times magazine. Brilliant. And they you know, want to talk about, you know, it was obviously referenced mental health. That's normally what I'd sort of bang on about. And I was like, yeah, they said they're going to do, you know, a shoot, and it was done, you know, it was all done, you know, according to the guidelines at the time, and ended up getting into this studio. The photographer's a great bloke. And then they had this stylist there, and she was like, I've got some stuff, I'm going to bring it out. Anyway, she pulls out this pink linen short. It's on the front cover of the Times. I got absolutely rinsed for it, but she pulled it was a short suit, you know, you got shorts and then an actual suit jacket, pink linen, and she brought it out, and I was like, what the fuck are you doing with that? She goes, no, just give it an opportunity, you know, give it a chance just to mix it up, because you're always in black. And I was like, well, I will do it, okay. And I came out and I was like, I quite like it, it's all good. Got the pictures done, and there was a load of other ones in jeans and a t-shirt and a few other bits and pieces. And I thought, they're obviously going to go with the jeans and t-shirt. And then it came out as that. And on it, mate, I was actually on a flight, and it came out in the morning, and I was like, oh my God, thank God I'm on a long haul flight. And I landed and my phone just went ballistic. I still get pulled up for it every now and again on different WhatsApp groups, but there we go. At least I've entertained.
Who rinsed you, or your old mates in the forces?
Yeah, I got, honestly, it got pushed out on Facebook or something, and I was just getting hammered. I still get hammered now for it. Someone will make reference to a pink suit, but I'm happy with it.
What happens when you all go on leave? I assume you go at the same time with some of your colleagues, and you all get in your civvy clothes. What do you have any clothes? I mean, what's it like? I mean, you know.
Yeah, everyone normally wears the same stuff, like jeans, t-shirt, and a pair of desert boots. It's just like that was what it was back in the day. Although I've got to say, Ollie, who I'm good mates with from the show, he used to push the boat out quite a bit when we were in. He used to sort of like peroxide his hair, and he always sort of tried to push against the flow, and in so doing, some of the dinosaurs used to get wound up by him, because he'd turn up in some like net backed tight skin tight fluorescent top that you'd wear at a rave or something. Yeah.
did you just used to come out and get absolutely battered? Go, what did you do? Go clubbing? Go watch bands? What did you lot do when you went on leave?
Yeah, pretty all of the above. It was, to be honest, I think the culture's changed slightly, because there was a big drinking culture in the military, especially when I first joined up and before it. And that went on until, it probably was still going reasonably strong when I was leaving. But I think it's taken a turn towards a more healthy sort of lifestyle. But there was, used to go out all the time, especially, you know, I spent a lot of time in a long part of my career living on camp. So you look like living in an accommodation block, and it's just hundreds of blokes in one place doing not an awful lot. You know, you might be playing on your PlayStation or something, and then the next thing you know, someone's like, ah, come on, let's go out on the source, because you've got nothing else to do. So it was great fun. But yeah, there was a lot of it that went on.
What about meeting women and stuff then? Did you have to go back to their places then? You couldn't bring them back to where you live.
No, well, blokes would try. But sometimes. And like that's, I think that was a lot of the time you'd be like, oh, you know, I need to live. We used to call it, because I was predominantly, when I came from the Marines, we called it living ashore. If you're not on base, you're ashore, even though you were, you know, it's just a reference to the naval sort of side of where we came from. And ended up, you know, everyone being like, oh, I need to get a rent a house or rent a room. Or, and I remember me and a mate of mine ended up, when I was quite young, we went rented a room each off this other guy, and he wasn't there, so we basically had the house quite cheap, but we couldn't afford to live there. We used to like nick rations from camp, bring them back, and we were in a house and we were cooking on a stove on a camping stove, and we thought we were gangster. Yeah, we were living ashore.
Do you leave the forces with any money? Because it's hard to spend it, I suppose. But do you don't get paid that much. So what happens?
You don't get paid much. The thing is, you go away for 6 months. on a tour of duty, you don't spend anything. Yeah. But then what happens is you come back and you genuinely think you're a rock star and you just go absolutely mental. And the next thing you know, before you get to go away again, you're cashing checks. Remember, you used to be able to cash checks back in the day. You used to like basically live in the never, never. So yeah, it never equaled out. When I left, I got a pension and, you know, you get a bit of a gratuity and that. It's not much, but it was enough to sort of sort yourself out while you're trying to work out what's next.
All right, next question. What do you do to keep fit?
Whatever, really. I get bored quickly with doing one thing repetitively. So I try and do a bit of running, try and do a lot of the gym, which obviously isn't happening at the moment. But, you know, I've got stuff at home that I use and I try and keep it mixed up. So a bit of HIIT training, that sort of thing.
Are you still loving it? Do you still love doing exercise?
I do. I think sometimes I actually injured my back a couple of weeks ago. And so I've had to stop completely, which is been actually a good thing because it's sort of, sometimes I get, you know, whenever I train sometimes you're like, can I be bothered? And I'm like, no, I've got to force myself. Whereas now I've had nearly 3 weeks off and I'm like itching to get back at it now. I'm going to give myself a little bit more just to make sure that I'm right and now I'm going to be good to go. So I try and, you know, even though I'm not training and it can be annoying, I'm sort of, instead of being annoyed, I'm just looking forward.
I injured my back the weekend before the first lockdown. And I basically, because I couldn't see anyone, couldn't get an MRI, couldn't do anything. I was lifting a sofa and I've had a back op, so I was worried about doing it. And it was torture. I mean, I remember getting to about week six and thinking, I just can't stand this. I need to exercise. What the hell can I do? And I was just going for these ridiculously long walks because I was trying my hardest. Only for an hour, if anyone's listening. maybe a bit more. But I was just going out. Like, I've got to do anything just to try and get that energy out of me. And I didn't know what to do. It was just, I mean, exercising. I find it really frustrating. My 18-year-old daughters at the moment are just not exercising. They've gone to university. Well, obviously, it's a pandemic. Pandemic and there's no netball clubs, there's no sport. But I'm going to get out and do some running, do something. And they're like, nah, I can't be bothered. And I just don't get that mindset where people don't exercise because I just love it. While you're doing it, it's not maybe amazing, but when you finish, it feels incredible.
Yeah, that's what I say to people when they're like, oh, what do you think I should think about if I don't want to go and do fit, like an exercise, go out for do whatever. I'm like, think about how you feel when it finishes.
That's it.
That's the thing. That's the point.
Think long term, not short term. Right. Tell our listeners something that has been life changing for you.
Life changing for me. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say the obvious because I've spoken about it too much. I'd say probably. There's a period that was life-changing, and that was definitely around the first series of SAS. And, you know, I met my missus now that I'm with, and it got me in, you know, it got me on the road to recovery, and it set in motion a lot of other things. So I'd say that's doing that series. I didn't know what it was going to look like. And I didn't really understand what it was going to be. I genuinely thought it was going to be a flash in the pan, one-off people, you know, military types would love it and that was it. And it was, you know, one of the directors actually was like, hey, he goes, this is going to be massive. You know, as soon as we finished, he said that. And I was like, whatever. Just sort of came away from it. But that has been quite life-changing, I'd say.
It's a good show though, isn't it?
Yeah, it does all right, yeah.
Yeah, how much more would you have to go to actually become like you guys from what they do, the contestants and the celebrities?
Probably go away for 6 months at a time getting shot at.
But I mean the training, because obviously
the training,
you do the mental side, but because the physical stuff you put them through.
One of the things that I think defines a lot of the guys that do it is the first 4 weeks of the actual course is spent running long distances, carrying heavy weight over the mountains of Wales, and no one, not one person, is shouting at you. No, you don't have to be there. You wake up in the morning and you can, like 4:30 in the morning, you can hear it raining outside. And you know in half an hour you've got to be down on a car park, stood there waiting to be told what vehicle to get into so you can set off on whatever it is you're doing. And no one is, there's no interaction. You know, and if you don't, even to the point where if you don't make the times on a certain march, you come, no one tells you that. You don't know what the times are. You don't know whether you passed or failed. You come back, you unpack, you sort your kit out, and then you go to the evening meal. And as you walk into the canteen area, there's a big board up as you walk in, and it's got everyone's name on it. You look for your name. If there's a red mark next to your name, you just disappear back, pack your kit, and off you go. You don't even, there's no, wow, absolutely no interaction. And it's, I think that is,
that's brilliant.
The motivation that you need to have within inside yourself to continually crack on, and there's a lot of people, you lose a lot of people in that first 4 weeks.
Yeah. All right. Do you have any daily routines? Next question.
Exercise normally, but most of the time I make sure I get up and make the bed and sort of just, clean or wash. Even if you're locked down, I'll go make sure that you have a shower and energize myself, and then do a bit of exercise.
Have you got the routine with the making the bed and getting exactly right from your days in the barracks and stuff? Do you still go with that? Is everything neat and organized in your house?
Yes and no. I think, yeah, it is, but it's not like it used to be. You know, you used to have to fold your clothes up. When you folded a set, whatever it was, everything had to be A4 sized,
right?
Which I find a bit bizarre now, but yeah, it's neat, but it's not that neat.
All right, next question. How's your mental health? Obviously, we know that you had to leave the forces because of your PTSD, and you've written this book. So, how is it at the moment?
Yeah, it's good. I think it will, you know, I'll never say never, never, you know, I still find myself waking up on a Monday morning, not this Monday though, obviously, I've been looking forward to this, but waking up on a Monday morning, sometimes you can be a bit like, feeling a bit groggy and stuff. But I think I know what I need to do to sort of get around that. I know how to, I mean, I'm better placed to deal with those moments so I don't end up in a proper pit.
When you wrote this book, did it cement some of the ideas in your head about how you actually have dealt with things?
Yeah, I think, do you know what? Yeah, as, yeah. And actually, we finished it, and then I went and recorded the audio and basically sat in a booth and spoke to myself, basically read what I'd written. And as I was going through it, it was like reaffirming itself in my mind. And I was like, do you know what? I actually, even though I've got a lot of other books that I refer to, you know, that are very, very good, I still think I might, and I'm not blowing my own trumpet at all. I don't mean that by any stretch of the imagination, but I will actually refer back to this sometimes just to remind myself about how I do think, because sometimes we do forget about some of our own coping strategies when we're in different places. And I'll probably have a look at it, see what I wrote about, you know, in a few years to come, and see if I can sort of, you know, let that help me sort of get through a patch again, maybe.
I think coping mechanisms in extreme circumstances is actually really helpful to how we can cope in mundane life. And I think, you know, there's the one lesson that I learned from doing this podcast is, Megan Hines says, you know, she's one of those experts, you know, those.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
You know her? Yeah, she does.
Yeah, yeah.
The sort of, what's his name? I can't think of his name now. What's the name of the?
Bear
Grylls. Yeah, she helps Bear Grylls and all that lot. And she said, if you're up a mountain and you break your leg, you can either whine about it and die because the Mother Nature doesn't give a damn, you know, how much money you've got, what sex you are, what race you are, how old you are, it will kill you. or you can accept the situation and try and get yourself down the mountain and or out of the jungle or whatever and try and survive. And that really hit home with me. And I remember I did the podcast with her, and then I know this is pathetic, but I'm going along in London on my Vespa at the time, and this policeman just steps out from nowhere and zaps me with a gun and goes, "Oh, you're speeding." And I was like, pull me over. And I was so angry. And I thought, just accept it. I know it's not, but just accept it. It's happened. Accept it. I just, every time anything happens to me, I go, broken leg, up a mountain in a jungle, got to get out. And I just, it just works. So, you know, that's why your book works well.
Yeah. But I think if I, just to put everyone else's minds at ease, it's normal life that is actually difficult, because ultimately, you know, all the things that go on in life, it's what I found the most difficult. And it was me having to, I had to consciously remember what I did in a gunfight as an extreme example to help me get through what I was finding difficult. And the reason we find life difficult is because we're never trained for it. I was trained to be a soldier. You know, mountaineers are trained to be up on the mountain, and they learn about survival techniques and they learn about first aid and that, but I was never taught to deal with bills or arguments or getting caught speeding. Do you know what I mean? It's something that's, so I think there is a lot to be referenced from extreme situations that can be overlaid onto what everyone actually finds really difficult.
What's the square meter thing? I love that.
The 1 meter square is basically, it was how, you know, me and my mates have always discussed about how do you talk about living in the now? You know, how, is there a way that you can visualize it? And it's like, imagine if you've got a meter square that you're the center of that meter square, you draw it around you and it follows you wherever you go in life. And ultimately, don't think about the bigger picture. It's like when people say to me, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I hate that. It freaks me out. I'm like, well, you know, I just want to be happy, but what I'm going to essentially do is live in that 1 meter square. Whatever comes into that meter square, I'll deal with, and then I'll be in another place, and I've got other stuff to deal with. It's like, well, I think we spoke about it on Sunday brunch, wasn't it? It was about the Atlantic row. If you thought about that in its entirety, it would freak you out, like 3,800 miles across an ocean that regularly kills people. Or you can forget about that bit and you just deal with that meter square. And then ultimately at the end of it all those meter squares have added up to 3,800 miles.
Yeah. It's Chinese, isn't it? Whoever have the, I'm going to muck this up because I always do, but they have the saying, a long journey always starts with one step. And I think that's probably better than that, but you know, if you just take one step in your square meter, you're all right. And then take another one and then keep going until you're there.
Yeah, exactly.
When was the happiest you've ever felt?
Probably now.
Really?
I think now. I mean, you know, put aside what everyone's going through, you know, now, I think, definitely. I think just where I am and what I'm doing, and I could look back on my past career, because I had a great time and I really did enjoy it and I've been happy in that as well, but I don't want to keep looking back and dwelling and reminiscing and being like, oh, that was the best time in my life. I think now I'd rather have a positive outlook on where I am now.
Yeah, your career is one of those ones which is front loaded because of the nature of the job, like a sportsman. It all happens when you're young, and then, but fortunately you've come out and got another career, which is good. All right, next question. What's it like to be famous?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really like that. I don't like thinking that I am. I don't think I am. Been on TV a few times. As its pros and cons, I'd say. You sort of got to be a lot more careful with what you say or write, whether that's on social media or in the whatever public domain you're working in. You've got to be a lot more careful, and you're under a lot more scrutiny, which can sometimes be a little, it can be not annoying. It can just be, you've got to think a lot more about what you say and do before it actually gets done. I think that's, I don't know whether that's a good or bad thing, but it is, my mind is slower because of it. I slow down because of it. if that makes sense.
Not only do you have to be careful about what you say for you, but you've also got to be careful what you say because you represent SBS, SAS, the forces. You represent all that lot as well, don't you? All you lot on TV, you're representing those guys. So
I'm added responsibility. And I do. I am very, very aware of that, and because I never want to bring anything into disrepute. And I've been on TV. Yeah, okay. Some people disagree with that, but ultimately, I would never do anything that would go against my own beliefs and my own moral standing.
Would you change? Would you do it all again? Would you join the forces again? Would you go and do it all?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I needed to do it. I was the kid that I was needed to do that, and it was a good thing. Put aside all the things people would see as a negative, leaving because of mental health issues or seeing friends get badly injured or die. That was that aside, I'd definitely do it all again.
Okay, just got a couple more questions. Last one. I've got one of the last ones. I like this one. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
I've always wanted to see a ghost, and I just don't think I have.
No, nor have I. I'm gutted.
I know, me too.
What about a UFO? Have you never seen a UFO when you've been out on mission somewhere?
I've thought I've seen something. There was one time when I was in the Marines. We were on a training exercise over in California, and we went out for a night. We're doing a night navigation exercise, and we're going over these mountains. It was dark and the sky was clear, and then all of a sudden we just saw this, it looked like a fireball screaming across the sky, and it was, I was actually like, is this the end of the world? Like, there was a we're in a four-man team. I was with a guy called Tony, a good mate of mine. We're like, what's that? And it's just sort of it sort of went and then it sort of like exploded. It looked like it exploded into a massive ball of color. And no one, we were like, what the hell was that? We ended up getting back to sort of finish the night navigation exercise, got back, went to sleep, got up in the morning, and then there was rumors of this thing because there was other guys that had obviously seen it. Anyway, it turns out it was the Americans were test firing an intercontinental ballistic missile, and that was it. It was it going into the, in through out of the atmosphere, apparently, on a test thing.
Intercontinental. What does that mean? It's going to leave the.
It's basically they're missiles that carry nuclear warheads. It's quite a dark subject, but they launch them from one continent to another, and to do the distance, they're basically like a rocket that leaves the Earth's atmosphere to sort of get that distance. But that was something close to being. At first, I didn't know what it was, but it was explainable.
Oh. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it, being in the when you're in the forces, because you get like there's a lot of ways people can get you, isn't there? Like, just it's not just ammunition. There's also I'm sure you've the gases and the chemicals and stuff like that.
Yeah,
did you ever get trained in that? Was there any
experience
of that happening to you guys?
It's quite depressing. There's a part of the syllabus when you're in training, and then also something that you continually do afterwards called NBC, which is nuclear, biological and chemical warfare, and you get taught in how to counter it. And it's, to be honest, it's grim. It is, there's not an awful lot that you can do against some of the things that we're not nice people devised to try and fight you. It's weird. You used to watch a lot of videos of the Russians and then testing stuff on their own troops. There was old archive footage, and it's like, why would you do that to your own people? It was bonkers. Although saying that, well, just quickly, this is something that you might actually like. This, you go onto YouTube and Google or search Royal Marines LSD training 1950s, and there's an old school black and white video. There's one that's about 3 minutes and one about 8 minutes, and they both of them have got the majority of what I'm going to be talking about. But they end up testing, unbeknown to the troops, they take them into sick bay. They give them some drugs that they say they're just going to try. I think it was water rehydration, something like that. they drink their water bottles, and they basically dose them up on LSD, and then they put them out into the field on a training exercise and film them to see whether it can incapacitate troops. And it is, although it sounds not funny, it is hilarious. You've got like, you've got these like professional soldiers that are literally some of them are incapacitated because they're laughing. One of them's climbed a tree. The other one's trying to chop a tree down with his weapon. It's ludicrous, and I find it bizarre that we used to do that.
In the Second World War, didn't some of the armies fight on speed and stuff? Didn't they give them speed in their
action? Yeah,
German army had speed, didn't they?
Yeah, I've heard things like that, the old amphetamines. I think the same went with the... I'm sure I've heard a story about the pilots in the Vietnam War. The American pilots used to sort of, you know, get dosed up on speed so they could continually keep concentrating for a long period of time.
Yeah, weird. Right, final question. Love this podcast. Really enjoyed it. Final question. I've asked you this once before. I'm going to ask you again. What's the meaning of life?
The meaning of life. I think there are probably there should be 7 billion meanings of life on this planet with regard to humans, because you got to make up your own meaning. Everyone always keeps going on about what is the meaning of life, you know, but it's like, there's billions of lives on this planet, and you've all got your own meaning. You've all got your own reason for being here. And I think it's up to a person. It's up to the individual. But for me, I'm just here. I want to have a good time. I want to enjoy it. I want to enjoy life.
Do you think life, after what you've seen and what you've been through, is life more or less valuable to you, do you think?
A lot more valuable, but I understand how fragile it is.
Humans are dicks as well, aren't we?
Yeah, I know. It's upsetting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, when you think about what any war would start with, you're like, I mean, it's like you're fighting over a piece of land, or you're fighting over a religion, or you're fighting over, I don't know. I mean, the Second World War is absolutely crazy. Well, the First World War is absolutely crazy, isn't it? And the Second World War is just, I mean, it's obscene what was happening. I mean, the whole thing is nuts. It's, I don't know.
I can't get why we don't learn from history. We're pretty bad at that, aren't we?
You go
and do history lessons at school, and then that doesn't really account for anything. History lessons should be about how you conduct yourself now, because look what happened in the past.
My mum would hate me for saying, well, I think it's because we don't treat people well, and people get angry, don't they? My mum will hate me for saying this, but she always says every problem with people is we have short memories and we forget what happened and the way we all were, the way we treated each other. And then we all just assume everyone's just going to get on and be happy. And it just doesn't work out like that. So, I mean, war's changed a lot though, hasn't it, now, because of the drone technology? I mean, I'm sure some of the jobs that you guys did will be replaced with drones now, right?
Yeah, 100%. It was happening when we were in, but I think, it will come to the point where they will have like robots that go to war. Why send humans when you've got, you know, tech that is, you know, probably a lot more expendable, but also a lot more capable.
Which is scary, because it means you're not sending any of our human life, say we're on one side, to, so there's not a commitment to losing life if you're going to go into war. It's just the opposition side. There's a thing they always say, don't they, that they should put the button to press the nuclear bomb in America or Britain, they should put it inside a human, so that if the president or the prime minister, in our case, wants to press that button, they've got to go through someone's rib cage first to do it, and actually kill someone to do it, so they can witness what death's like before they press that button, because pressing a button's a lot easier than killing a man.
That is a very good way of putting it.
Mm.
There's a lot of the decision makers, I don't think they have a grasp on what is actually happening and what the fallout is for some of these decisions.
Yeah. Mate, it's been a pleasure talking to you as always. Really enjoyed it.
Likewise.
Thanks a lot. Hopefully I'll bump into you again soon. So you
put
under fire. And you, where's the best place to follow you on social media at the moment?
Instagram, probably. It's an easier platform, I think. Jason_Carl_Fox, I think.
Perfect. Top man. Yeah. Thank you so much. Speak to you soon.
Mate, thanks again. Yeah, that was awesome. Cheers.
Dear Lovejoy is written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Blake Fallows. It's brought to you by Cooker, spelled Quooker. Check them out at cooker.co.uk. That's spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you want to get in touch with Tim, email dearlovejoy@gmail.com. And Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.